let's go ahead and get started. And thank you so much for coming to our Women We Admire speaker series. My name is Margaret Wu. I'm one of the co-vice chairs of PACSAW, the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women. And I'm very pleased to be able to present Professor Kelly McElhaney from UC Berkeley campus to come speak with us today. Just some quick thank yous to the Women We Admire subcommittee. Luana Putney, our chair, unfortunately couldn't be here today, but also Xiaohui and Jenny Cao and myself work on this committee, so we're really very grateful for you to come. Also, a quick plug for our next speaker, Jane Connolly, who is currently Dean of UC Santa Barbara's Graduate School of Education. You may know she was the interim chancellor at Riverside, and she was just appointed the first woman president at CSU Long Beach. So I did confirm she is still coming to speak with us in April. So we're really lucky to have her, and I'm sure she'll have some great stories. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Nathan Rostrom, who's going to introduce our speaker today.
Thanks so much, Margaret, and welcome, everyone. I also want to join in welcoming Kelly McElhaney. I had the great privilege of working with Kelly when I was at the Berkeley campus. Dr. McElhaney is the Whitehead Faculty Fellow and the founding faculty director of the Center for Responsible Business at the Haas School of Business. She launched the center in 2003 and has become one of the core competencies of corporate responsibility in the Haas School offering. She also has written a book recently entitled Just Good Business, The Strategic Guide to Aligning Corporate Responsibility and Brand, and has given a TED Talk on the topic. I worked with Dr. McElhaney when we were looking at leveraging alternative revenues. We were looking at everything we could do to get through the financial crisis, and so we looked at things like outsourcing trademark and licensing, developing other corporate sponsorships. We wanted to do this, but we also wanted to do it in a way that was not only consistent, but also promoted the university's values. And Kelly was invaluable in helping us sort of thread that, in doing it in a way where we kept precious all the things that we hold dear. She really is a national and international leader in this area, and I have to say this is an area that's evolved so dramatically over the past decade. And when I think about, you know, socially responsible investing a decade ago, it was all focused on sort of negative screens. You know, we're not going to invest in tobacco or firearms or Sudan or and then since that time, though, it's about what do we want to invest in? We want to invest in, you know, in companies that look out for gender equity, companies that pay a living wage, companies that have the highest standards on health, safety, and the environment. And that has really made this whole area of corporate social responsibility much richer and much more robust. And a lot of it is really due to the research of Dr. McElhaney and a lot of her colleagues. So it's a very important topic for the university, and I really appreciate that it is a real cornerstone of the Haas Business School curriculum. I think that really is something that Dean Lyons and all the professors value it that much to make it one of the framing principles. So with that, I welcome Kelly, and hope you enjoy the talk.
Thank you. You talk about CS corporate social responsibility. I'm like, did we not tell him I'm speaking about women today?
I
know. It is. No, it absolutely is. Our kids go to school and play volleyball together, so we also know each other that way. So thanks for having me today. Just a show of hands, how many of you have to leave right at 1? Because I'm getting started just a few minutes late. I just don't know how fast to talk. Should I quit at 1? All right. Let me just jump into it then. A little bit more about who I am. I'm an ex-banker. So I got happy and twer when I came to Cal. But I actually started at the University of Michigan, where I went for my PhD and founded the Center for Responsible Business at Haas School of Business. We were just rated this year today, just came out the Financial Times Business School rankings, and we were rated in corporate social responsibility as number 1 in the world. I don't have it anymore, but somebody else, one of my former students, runs it. I've been charged by Dean Lyons to launch a new center, an initiative around women, so I'm just at the very beginning stages of that. And I do a lot of corporate consulting and work historically in corporate social responsibility, but when I switched gears 2 years ago, I thought, oh no, I just killed all of my consulting because who's going to want work in women? And I'm amazed at how many companies have brought me in to help them develop a women's investment strategy. Just some background that's more personal about why I'm interested in women. it turns out, I didn't know this until I got older. I knew it, but I didn't connect the dots until I got older. My father is an ex-college football player at Duke, when Duke, well, they do have a good football team again, but he really did nothing. And he went to the Orange Bowl, and he became a pro player. But then he went back and coached and became an athletic director. So his whole career was as an athletic director, and he was one of the original authors of Title IX, which was crazy because I remember hearing all these discussions at the dinner table of these amazing female athletes that he would interact with but didn't have a team to put them on. And he got, you know, job firing threats and all kinds of things for standing on Title IX. So clearly that had an impact on me, as much as I tried to not show him that he had an impact on me. Now I do, and he's really proud. And other reasons I became interested in women, because I used to pretend like I wasn't a woman, particularly as a banker. I wore navy black or gray suits. I even wore the dreaded necktie. And I didn't have any female role models when I was a banker. I then had two young women who are crazy strong-willed. I don't know where they get that. And then as I was doing research in the area of corporate social responsibility, I started to notice that women were more naturally sustainable leaders. And I'll tell you about that later. And that's how I segued over. We have our own issues with being not desirable degree for women. We have 28% females at Haas right now. It's gone anywhere from 21 to 30, and that's the national norm. Harvard somehow boasts 50, and I don't know. What I hear is they're able to buy women with scholarships. That's what people tell me. So I don't know what's going on there, but there are not a lot of women in leadership in business school. And then I just know I'm a banker, right? So I look at ROI, return on investment, and I know that women have a huge return on investment, which I'll show you. The first time I wrote a paper on this topic, it was a really long title with a colon and a semicolon because that made me appear smarter. And I was sitting next to Bobby Shriver at this event when they were launching Product Red. And Product Red are now 14 brands who have branded products together that the proceeds go to fighting AIDS and disease in Africa. And he was telling me that he learned something from P. Diddy called, I think he was Puff Daddy at the time, called the Lioness Factor. I won't go into the details of the story, but basically P. Diddy told Bono and Bobby Shriver that they needed to engage women in Product Red to be successful. And he said, you know what lions do every day? I like men, but please, it's not an anti-man message at all. That apparently in the jungle, lions wake up every day and find the biggest shade tree in the jungle and fall asleep for the day. And lionesses get up and get the cubs ready for school and hunt, gather, kill, maim, murder, and bring back all the food. And most of the men in my MBA class say, well, who's smarter in that picture? So I started to look at this concept of the lioness factor. So today, I'll run you through a lot of data, and I'm happy to give you my presentation because I'll go fast through the data and really make the business case. I mean, I am a business school prof, and so I'm really business-driven. And even with corporate social responsibility, I pretended that I didn't morally or ethically care about it, but I really cared about it because of the money and the value that comes from it. And of course, I ethically and morally care about it, but that didn't seem to be the best way to lead an argument in the business world. And I do the same with women. It's pretty obvious I care because I outed myself as a woman, but I want to make the business case. I'll just really fast go through my research because it's probably not as appropriate. And then last year, I was asked to give a talk at Dreamforce, the big Salesforce conference in San Francisco, and they asked you to do something really differently. They said, you know, we don't want you to be a boring professor. We know you have a lot of data and research, but could you tell your personal story, too? It's really scary. My voice was shaking. And, like, nobody asks me for your personal story, especially a professor. And so I started to weave in some of my personal story just because I think it drives it home. And it's amazing when you open up to the universe and show some vulnerability how much more people connect with you. So just back to the business case, Harvard Business Review says we are the largest market opportunity in the world. If you haven't seen Half the Sky, which is a book and now a documentary by Christoph and his wife, Udon, it's phenomenal. It follows the plight of women in six different countries and what would happen if you reverse the plight on certain things like lack of access to education or maternal mortality rate. It's really fascinating. But they say, and I love this, we're not part of the problem, we're part of the solution. And the words I try to get people to not use anymore are women's issues, because it assumes that we have issues. And I still call it women's opportunity, because I think we represent an opportunity. And then the Chinese proverb that women hold up half the sky. So now you not know me out of that, and I guess not yet, but the next slide. I'm a huge sports fan, and I loved Nike's Olympics launch commercial in the last Olympics. And so I'll show it to you on the next sleeve. That's what I don't know how to do. Yeah.
Just didn't run in public.
No one on my all-boys team was asked to me.
Dad told me I couldn't be a boxer. He said I was too small.
There was a guy who tried to spit on me and pushed me out of his way.
There comes a point where you have to be sure of yourself. People aren't used to women being so passionate. It scares them.
One day, I just said it doesn't matter what other people think.
I'm a fashion model who can dunk.
I'm a girl. That doesn't mean I have to wear a skirt.
Doesn't mean I can't get all fired up.
They used to say, that girl is crazy.
But then I just kept winning.
I didn't set out to dominate. I just did.
Somebody's got to be the best. So why not me?
I'm 55 years old and I run close to 70 miles a week.
I never felt like quitting.
Doug's been telling me to do it every single day. Just want to play ball.
That was really symbolic because the Summer Olympics were the first time in Olympics history that every country sent at least one woman to the Olympics, and women gold medal winners outstripped men gold medal winners at the 50th anniversary of the 25th anniversary of Title IX. Which anniversary? I can't remember. Must be the 50th because that's my dad is 7 gloves. So it's a big year. But what this spoke to me about was how much we are trained to follow the rules as women. And how many women are here leaving the corporate world or whatever their work worlds are because they don't feel like it fits their rules. And what frustrates me about that is, why don't we actually start making the rules or changing the rules as opposed to following the rules? So the question I asked myself when I started to embed on this journey, and I'll be honest, I asked myself this in hiding because I was told pretty clearly by folks at the business school that this wasn't an appropriate research question for a business school, that I should go to gender studies. And so I kind of went underground and said, I don't care, I'm going to ask it anyway. And I looked at this concept of, do we live in a gender-forward world? I'm interested in equality, but you can't get to equality if you aren't forward-moving first. So the data fascinated me. Even I had a strong gut, but the data blew me away. You know, we're in the developed world, and we're supposed to be so innovative and forward-thinking, and I was shocked in 2012 that IBM is the biggest sponsor of the Golf, the Nationals, and yet the CEO of IBM, Virginia Rometty, could watch from the stands but still couldn't play at Augusta because they didn't let them play on the course yet. That was very shocking to me. They did reverse that and let three women in, which we're supposed to rejoice. Condoleezza Rice is in, and I don't know the other two, but not Virginia. It's interesting to me. And then I couldn't have gotten into this field at any better time. The Republicans absolutely nailed it. So we know that before Obamacare, being a woman was a pre-existing condition. And this brilliant Fox doctor said that men should not pay as much as women for insurance because we only have the prostate. Women have the breasts, the ovaries, the uterus. They get checked in every part. So we should pay more for health care. And then on a much more serious note, that's just ridiculous. There was a rape case, I think I'm right, last year, and this judge, a 14-year-old girl was raped by her teacher, and this judge determined that she asked for it because she was chronologically older than her age, and she was as much in control as her adult male teacher. And, you know, when you have two daughters, and this is the world you're sending them out in, it's pretty chilling that this is happening, and it could go on forever. Then there's some funny stuff that Vic, Grace, a liberal enlightener woman, put out a new product in 2012 that is still around in 2014, so somebody's buying it, into it. That it's called Vic Pen for Her, and my daughter actually pointed at that when we were back to school shopping at Target and said, what? Really? I need a pen that is sparkly and pink? And so I did some research, and Amazon has these hilarious product reviews. Finally, for years I've had to rely on pencils or at worst a twig and some drops of my pencil to write down recipes. The only thing a lady should be writing ever. Thank you, Elastic, the great liberator, has released a womanly pen that my gentle baby can use without fear of unladylike calluses and bruises. And I love this. The men got in well, too. Hey, men, don't stand to this. I'm doing enough products specific to women already. First it was tampons, now these pens. What other products do I have to suffer the indignity of being unable to purchase just because I'm a real person? So there's a lot going on in the developing world. Sorry, the developed world. It feels like the developed world that says we're still pretty subjugated. Super excited to hear Obama and his State of the Union address talk about women. Women make up about half our workforce, but they still only make 70 cents for every dollar. It's wrong. It's an embarrassment. A woman deserves equal pay for equal work. And then later in the talk, and I'm really happy that he added this, a woman deserves to have a baby without sacrificing her job. A mother deserves a day off to care for a sick child or a sick parent without running into hardship. And this is fantastic. And you know what? A father does, too. Because this is not just a woman's challenge. And particularly with this younger generation, these men don't want to work 80 hours a week. They want to go home and have dinner with their kids. So this next generation, I think, is going to demand a lot more change than my generation. We just acted like men. And yes, we made headway, and the women above me who really still act like men, because that's what they had to do to get to where they are, I'm grateful to them. But I hear my MBA students say, I don't want to do that. The men and women, that's not what I want to do with my life. So some economic analysis. Just last week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, they released, it started in 2006. It's called the Gender Gap Index, and they look at every country, and they calculate the gender gap or equity inside the country. And they show that countries who have no gender gap or less have a much higher GDP. Mm. And so all the economists wake up, all the prime ministers and the president say, huh, we should look at that. And this just shows GDP and gender gap. So the less gender gap, the higher the GDP. You know the world of higher education and that girls are graduating with more degrees than are boys. And girls are outperforming boys now in primary and secondary education. And so we're doing quite well educationally. Again, the business case, companies want access to women's dollars. One of the fastest growing female consumer base is with the NFL. So there's been this movement to pinkify the NFL. And, you know, to give up team wear that doesn't look boxy like a big mesh football jersey that doesn't really appeal to us. So that's been fantastic. Retail healthcare companies, healthcare decisions are primarily made by women for self and family. And even consumer electronics, about 4 years ago, Best Buy revamped their strategy because they found they were selling more and more to women, and so they wanted to make it more appealing to women. A lot of data on this slide, but bottom line is we represent a significant amount of market power. It's estimated that by the end of this year, we'll represent $29 trillion, and so you can imagine companies want access to that. We're called the greatest growing spending bloc on the planet, more than two times China and India together, and yet you'll see companies who have a China growth strategy or an India growth strategy, but not a woman's growth strategy. So the smart companies are really starting to figure that out. You don't have to, it's kind of blurry, but their Credit Suisse came out with a phenomenal study in 2011 that showed that share price stock performance fared better if there were women in leadership. Not getting rid of men, but just getting more women. Companies with more women in leadership performed better in volatile markets. Share price was higher. Debt to income ratios were lower. So a lot of really interesting business arguments of why we need to invest in women. Plus the kind of the good news and bad news and funny news. The sad statistics, though, show that we're not really breaking through whatever you want to call it, the glass ceiling, the male ceiling, the sticky floor. There's all kinds of interesting names for it. And the number 16 seems to be the percentage that we can't bump out of. So this shows board. Companies who have a woman on the board in the Fortune 500, 16.6. I think it went down this year a little bit. And there's a lot of double counting because you have Meg Whitman and Marissa Meyer who serve on multiple boards. So it's really complex. These are officer positions, so CEO, president, chief marketing, chief human resources, again, 15.7%. So there's that strange 16%. Watch out for data misrepresentation. So this got thrown around, and look how look how great women in top executive positions or top CEO positions are doing. But what's funny about that scale is that's only 7%. I mean, they stretched it out. If they had done it on a 100% scale, it would look very differently. But so you have to be really careful about what, how people present this argument.
Women only men?
Oh. Women like men only keep $0.77 on the dollar. A lot of economists argue over that number, and the highest I've seen an economist be able to prove it is 81 cents. And the way they do this is some of it's good. They normalize for academic majors, industry, functions in the industry, so human resources heavily dominated by women, lower pay than finance. Then there's this other great economist team out of Wharton, UPenn, and it says they calculate women's wages are lower because women work fewer hours in the workplace than men, which is probably true in the workplace because a disproportionate amount of home, house, childcare goes to women, or we log on after the kids go to bed at night. So whatever the number is, it's still different. And I love this. Cohen O'Brien says, according to a new study, most men would like women to occasionally pick up a check. Study also found that women would occasionally like to be paid as much as men for doing the same job. So really, during the last election, there were some really great comments that came out because the Republicans, you know, put women so much in the spotlight in a negative way. It's worse if you just look down the highway. Silicon Valley is one of the worst places to be a woman. 49 cents per dollar. Only 8% of venture-backed tech startups are owned by women. 40% nationally. This is crazy. Women receive less than 3% venture funding from those wonderful VC firms. And if you're African American, it's even worse. And essentially 100% of funded founders of these new and middle-sized companies are white or Asian. And the founding teams are all male. Twitter went public with a male founding team and no women on the board. Facebook went public with no women on the board. They finally promoted Sheryl Sandberg. Silicon Valley's the worst, which really frustrates me. I can tell you horror stories. I'll tell you the one about Pitt Spare. TechCrunch Disrupt happens every year. And investors, also all venture capitalists and investors in the audience and, you know, people, kids who are pitching new businesses go up on stage. And the first team that went up on stage were two men, and they were joking, and they said they had a new app called Pitt Spare that would help men stare more clearly into women's bosoms. And it was a joke, but the fact that this was the first group that got on stage was a little disturbing. Twitter I talked to you about. So what are the reasons? And that's kind of what I'm studying now. Why? It's just astounding, but why? First thing I learned that was really disturbing is that we all went to the same school of gender bias. So women are biased against women as well as men are biased against women. It might be different areas, but how many times have you heard a fellow woman say, I'd rather work for a man than a woman. I hate working with women. I don't want to work in an all-women team. And this whole girl-on-girl violence stuff is challenging in the way the media promotes it. Working moms versus non-working moms and fighting. Women executives fighting in the boardroom. It's really disturbing. There is a paucity of female role models, so the old adage, you can't see what you can't see, turns out to be the single biggest predictor. So having women in leadership is the single biggest predictor that young women will continue to try to rise up the ranks. They need to see it. But it's also complex because there are also studies that show if you do promote one woman into the leadership team or the board, the company then feels like they've checked the box and they don't continue. Same, I'm sure, with racial and ethnic diversity. Oh, I've got that one. And if I get one black woman who is, you know, physically challenged, boom.
Yeah.
I'm going to, oh, and if she's lesbian, it's even better. So that's trouble. There are gendered career paths. You can show that different functions are heavily female-dominated and other functions are heavily male-dominated, so we view work as being gendered. And gendered expectations. So in the corporate world, it's expected that you're running a really high profit and loss statement before you get promoted into profit and loss units before you get promoted into leadership, or it could be expected that you'll do a management rotation throughout the company, so you have to move every 2 years, or have worked globally, which is really hard if you're a working mom with kids and a working husband. So that's a challenge. This concept that we have lack of access, like Virginia Rometty to the golf course where deals are made, or just the network at the bar, the scotch drinking contests or whatever it is that they do. Two really funny stories on that. The first is a story from a friend of mine who's on a senior public board, who's on a big public company board. She tells this story of a terribly tense board meeting, and they were going way late into the night, like 2 in the morning. They had to make a very difficult decision, and they stopped the meeting to have a bathroom break. And she and one other woman went off to the, obviously, to the women's room, and the rest of the men went off to the men's room. And they came back. Yeah. They came back 10 minutes later, and the guy, the head of the board, said, okay, so we're good. We're going to do it. What's the plan? And they were like, what's a plan? And it turns out in the urinals, they had made the plan and come back. So these things really exist. And then Sheryl Sandberg, if you read her book, talks about this fascinating experience. Early days of Facebook, she was in New York City pitching Facebook to a high-level private equity firm. It was a 3-hour pitch. And she, at break, said, could you show me to the male venture capital director? Could you show me where the women's room is? She looked at her and went, no, I don't know where the women's room is. She said, do you have a restroom? And he said, I've never been asked for it before. You're the first woman who's come in and pitched. So a lot of that is even more called implicit bias, things that we don't actually even think about or see. And then there's this other phenomenon called the double bind. The double bind. And this is a fantastic experiment done by one of my male colleagues at Haas. There is, well, I won't show you this yet. There's a classic case called the Heidi Morrison case. And Heidi is a real woman venture capitalist found in Silicon Valley. And Harvard originally wrote a case about her because she's a phenomenal networker, and they're trying to show the power of personal networks. But it's nothing to do with women or anything. But it's got a female protagonist, which is rare for this school cases. So Cameron decided to split his, he had two sessions of MBA students. He decided to teach the Heidi case. In one case, it was Heidi. Second case, second class, he switched the name from Heidi to Howard. The top of the case, did all his learning, never mentioned anything to either class, you know, 80 kids, 80 MBA students, so they're 7 years out of work, they're not young. 7 years out of undergrad. And then he did some testing on the protagonist, and how did you feel about Heidi versus Howard? And the findings were fascinating. How genuine were Heidi versus Howard? Howard is yellow, Heidi is whatever, that beige. Howard was seen as more humble, more kind, and more genuine. Same character, same case, just different gender. It's worse. How power hungry, how self-promoting, how fit and genuine. We don't like Heidi, look at her. She's power hungry, self-promoting. How confident, how self-confident, and how effective. The same. I mean, pretty much the same. And then finally, how much did you like him? Would you hire, and would you enjoy working with Heidi Howard? So we know this. How many of you women have been called aggressive, bossy, emotional, crazy? All these labels that men just don't seem to. A mental case. One of my girlfriends got a text from her ex-husband last night and said they're a mental case. Oh my gosh. I thought a lot of things. So that's a very fast trip through the business world. Some specific research that I'm really excited to get out there because I again do care, as I said, about corporate social responsibility and how do you make the world a better place through the power of business or organizations or people. So I met this phenomenal woman when I gave a TED Talk. She's Icelandic, Halla Tómasdóttir, and she started the first in Iceland. She's a finance woman. She started the first values-based investment fund, not values, but values-based investment fund with a colleague, set some values of, you know, who they would and wouldn't invest in from a company perspective based on the values, the mission, the vision of the firm. And in 2008, the whole market crashed. The entire country of Iceland crashed, except for this fund. It was, it outperformed all other funds before the market crash, and it actually survived the crash. And she She's now called it Sister Capital, Sisters Capital. She's done it with three women, and they've started funds all throughout the world in Europe. So I loved her. And she said, yeah, corporations build better societies if they have gender-balanced leadership. They're just better companies. And so I asked myself a question. Well, first I said, what if it had been Lehman Sisters? And then I realized that's the wrong question, because I don't want to get rid of men. So I asked, what if it had been Lehman Siblings? Would the world have looked any different in terms of Lehman Brothers and what happened, or in terms of BP and the oil spill, or Apple and workers committing suicide in their iPad factories in China, any of it? Davos this year had, last year they had 19% women attend, oh, sorry, 16%, whatever, I don't know where the 16 barrier is. This year it dropped down to 15% women attend Davos, only 3% are on the stage. Only 6% of the people on the stage were women. So you can't see it. My research question was, I wanted to look at women in leadership of the company. I wanted to look at what my data set called ESG, environment, social, and governance performance of the company, and then the business value. Because obviously, in my world, we get measured on business value. So people had already looked before, and like I said, the Credit Suisse study and Catalyst had looked at having more women in leadership and better financial value in the firm. So I just cited that research. A lot of research, as you know, has gone into sustainability, being greener, more energy efficient, all those things, how it raises the return on the company because you're less packaging, less waste, less water usage. But I wanted to know if there are more women in leadership, is the company more socially responsible? So I went out to see what else had been done, and there was only one study, of course, by Harvard, because they always get there first. And they looked at just simply giving money away, philanthropy, companies giving money away. And then the first, they looked at companies with zero directors, female board members, and $959,000 was the average given away in terms of philanthropically. If you had three or more women directors, it grew to $27.1 million. That's huge. So why are women more philanthropically minded? If you had women in leadership, almost the same number, $985,000, $12.8 million was women in the C-suite. That's pretty phenomenal. I'm like, well, okay, giving away money isn't everything, but it's a piece of corporate social responsibility. So as I said, I looked at a data set that rated the, so independent rating, took Fortune 1500 companies and rated their environment, social, and governance performance, which I'll explain what those variables look like. And we found that companies with more women on their board of directors are likely to manage and improve their energy efficiency, which we know would return positively financially to the firm, reduce carbon emissions of the company's operations, simply reduce their packaging. So, you know, a lot of ways to overpackage these things that cost everybody more money. And invest in renewable power. You've got to get women into leadership if you care about these things in the world. That was the most significant correlation. The second most significant correlation was on the S, the social side, things like offering access to health care for all of the workers, even the coffee shop baristas who are out there doing the hard work at Starbucks. And offer really improve the health and nutritional profile of their product offerings. So when Indira Nooyi, Indian female, took over Coca-Cola, she immediately started rebalancing their product offerings, and Wall Street hated it, said she needs to get her share price up. But instead, she worked on healthier, more nutritional products and drink categories, and they've done absolutely fine and really beaten Pepsi heavily on this. More proactively made its talent, which is something that every company is talking about right now, because millennials are hard to manage under 30 because they don't stay loyal to a company. They do want to leave it for. They are on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever they're all on every day. It's really hard to manage them, but women tend to do a better job of keeping them engaged. And then offer just transparent, well, this was a really weird, we listed it just because it was super high correlation, but to offer transparent financial products so that we wouldn't have had until mortgage crisis or people buying, you know, expensive cars and they had so much credit debt. So that was positive. And then finally, least correlated but still above statistical significance, simply fewer CEOs carted off in handcuffs. Less misreporting of numbers, less fraud, less corruption. So this was a great study just to prove to the business world that we do add value beyond financial value, but also just in terms of making the world a better place. I've raced through the data. Any questions before I get more personal? Any thoughts or reactions?
surprises.
Yeah.
About the gender career paths, what that represents?
Yeah, I don't know higher ed as well, but I know corporate better. But the gender career paths are career paths, like, for example, to get onto a board of director right now, the job description says implicitly you have to have been a CEO or president, or currently be a CEO or president, and we know that that already disqualifies women. They had to run a huge profit and loss department in the company. Women tend to do general counsels are more likely to be women inside of companies. Chief operating officer is an area in which women have done well, but they're not managing profit and loss statements. Or there's this other, I don't want to get off too much track, but I love social psychology. There's this concept called homophily, which is that we tend to hang out with, invite people just like us. So when you've got only 3% of Silicon Valley companies run by women, when the average Silicon Valley-centered-backed man starts a company, he looks at his friends as sort of cronies and puts them on. That's what Twitter. In fact, we have on Twitter. It was all of Dick Costello's and Ebb's, all the founders' best friends, same old people. So that's where you get a gender career path. Good question. Other? I don't know what your feedback is. Any other thoughts? Does this surprise you, depress you? Yeah. I teach a new course in this space in the MBA program last year, first time, this year, second time. And what struck me the most as I was teaching this course, A, that there are men in the class, which was awesome and I think a huge testament to Berkeley and our reputation. But what surprised me, made me really sad, was how many people were shocked in the classroom. Mm. Like, they just they had no idea. Because you figure these people are 28 years old, their experience has been pretty gender neutral because they haven't gotten up high enough. Mm-hmm. Or there's another phenomenon called the tiara syndrome. Who's heard of the tiara syndrome? Brilliant. I use this. I think about this with my girls all the time. Girls do better in education than do boys. Girls do less well in the business world than do boys, men, women, whatever you want to call it. And there's this great social psychology theory that says it's because we are really good at waiting for our crown to be placed on our head. So we study harder, we write longer papers, we do better on tests, and then somebody crowns us with an A. And it's it works. And then you get into the business world or like whatever world, and you wait, you sit back and wait. You do a really good job, you work really hard, you turn everything in on time, you blow it out of the water, but you sit back and wait for somebody to come and say, here's your Oscar. And they don't. And men are much better at saying, here's my project, here's how I made my numbers, here's why I need a raise, here's the raise that I expect. And so that's one of the reasons, don't wait for your Oscar, don't wait to be crowned a princess or a queen. Crown yourself and just walk in as the queen. And it's a lot of what Sheryl Sandberg talks about in her book. That's my hand here, and then I'll go back.
Well, I'll comment on that. It's quite surprising that this is coming up now. Most of the time you hear about gender equality,
right,
so not in developing countries.
Right.
And in developing countries, you see that it's a lot more open, where in Africa you have more female presidents than in a developed country.
Right.
But nobody seems to pay attention to all the growth that's happening in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
And in the developed world, you talk a lot about gender equality, but when you actually do the research, it's not there. The media paints it out where developing countries, this is what is happening, people are marginalized, they're suffering. When you look,
and we don't talk about it. I mean, Oakland is the biggest U.S. city for sex trafficking of girls.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knows that. It is amazing what we don't talk about. But you hear about female genital mutilation. Or you hear about rapes in India. Rapes have never been higher on college campuses than they are today. And you're more significantly likely to see a acquaintance rape than a stranger rape. On college campuses, look at the rape case in Pennsylvania, the football player, the girl committed suicide. The guys got off until she committed suicide, and then they retried the case. So a lot of my, and we have a lot of international, 36% of our MBA population are international, and we have really rich discussions, and there's a whole other set of data that shows that if you invest in a dollar in a girl in the developing world, 70 cents on that dollar goes back to improve the community. Her education, her kids' education, their health, their economic power. For a man, 30 cents goes back to the community. understand, like, where do you think the 70 cents go? Alcohol? Gambling? Prostitution. So again, I get nervous meeting with that data because it sounds like I'm in, and I'm not. But then they're just facts that are facts. So anyway, shut up. Go on, Carolyn. Yes.
So my whole question going through, I have 3 daughters, and I have, like, the highest degree in my profession of PhD in education. Is where is that tipping point where girls do so well in school, overrepresented, very represented in undergraduate education, climbing in graduate education, where is the tipping point where we fall off? And we're not getting to the director position, VP, CEO, chancellor, president. And I see my girls in school, they do well. And I see the boys, they misbehave, but then that misbehavior isn't rewarded later in life because they have attention deficit disorder, but they're president of company. You know, and I'm trying to figure out how to work within this social structure so that my girls can be as, and for myself, as successful as you can.
Well, the higher ed data is even more, we're doing worse in the academic profession. Just, so women last year earned more PhDs than men in certain fields, but they still are getting tenure at the same rate. They still are being seen as high on the service, but low on the research. There's some really interesting studies in science that they tried for 1 year in this top journal in science to put first initial last name on the submissions, and they, the acceptance rate of female-authored articles went way up. So there's a lot happening. You know, I go home and I think, I can only deal with one horrible woman. Academia, I can't tell the story. The fact that the Berkeley men and women's faculty clubs weren't integrated until 71 just blows me away. I think every kind of work is walking into the men's faculty club and see the moose head or whatever. I don't know what kind of head it is. But on the wall, I think, no one,
the story I heard about that is when they talked about merging earlier, the women's faculty club said, we want to look at your books, and the men's faculty club was not very financially sound, so they said, no, we don't want to merge.
And the women's faculty club are far better food anyway. I saw that on hand. I have some instinctive thoughts. There was just a really good report. Fenwick and West, I think it's the law firm. If it's not, it's a different law firm. I think it's Fenwick. Just did a study. Not the why, but what the numbers really look like. I think tech is so overrepresented in Silicon Valley and so underrepresented with women. Women deselect computer science, engineering. So it's a pipeline issue, even though I hated it when Dick Costello, CEO of Twitter, said if we couldn't find any value payments. He said on Twitter, stupid. We couldn't find any women board members. There's none around. And a business leader for Fortune responded with a list of 25 women in like 3 minutes. So that's part of it. You kind of jokingly talk about ADD and autism, but there's the belief that there's a high level of autism or at least Asperger's among Silicon Valley tech leaders, which I think would make them more prone to business tunnel vision of not looking at the big picture. You know, I don't even know. It overwhelms me, the other reasons. Cronyism is super high in the venture capital world. You have to be on a board to then get other board invites, and so women just never break into that whole space. I had a good friend who is a venture capitalist with a big firm in Silicon Valley, and he funds in cloud-based technology. He and I were talking one day about this research. He made a comment to me on Facebook that I'm really becoming an angry woman. And I was a little shocked because I called him and said, can we get together for drinks? Because I actually used to like you. We talked, I'm like, what? Tell me about this. When we talked about that stuff. And I said, how many boards do you sit on? Because every time they make an investment, he sits on the board. And he sits on 9 boards. And I said, how many women are on those boards? And he starts to count. And I'm like, well, that's kind of cool. Tell me the 9 companies and not one having one. And then more disturbing part of that, he had never thought about.
Right.
Never occurred to him.
Why is that a problem?
Yeah, just even noticing it. That is a problem. You know, not even say it's a problem yet, but wow, isn't that funny that my 9th board meeting this month, I haven't interacted with a female except for the assistant or the admin who organized the whole meeting.
So it's dire.
dad and the impact he had on me. And I don't want to say my mom didn't, because she absolutely did. I'm so badly. I've got to get a picture of her up there. Moms get no credit. Anyway, so my dad, just the impact, and he never, ever talked about gender. He talked about performance on the field or on the court or in the pool, and there just wasn't a gender difference. He just said, you know, Kel, all that matters is your performance on the ground. So that was ingrained into me. As I said, I had two daughters, and so I spent a lot of time thinking about what kind of a world I'm sending them out into, what's the impact on the world, of the world on them when they want to get their eyebrows waxed at age 11. Where are they picking this up? And, you know, absolutely, I can tell you stories of Cheryl, you know, daughters can see it. My daughter came from kindergarten. The youngest came home from kindergarten and told me her thighs were fat. And that, you know, she didn't even know the word thigh. She never heard it. So I asked her where that came from, and she heard it on the playground that day from some boys. And she still pulls her skirts down. Or, anyway, so that had a huge effect on me. And then this is a little bit more personal, so maybe too TMI, but I'll TMI it anyway. Anna Quinlan is just a wonderful author. I love a lot of her books. And she wrote this book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, about her own life. And it opened up with this, and I loved it. First, I was who I was. Then I didn't know who I was. Then I invented someone and became her. Then I began to like what I'd invented. And finally, I was who I was again. And I had chills when I read this because of the time frame in my life and, you know, sort of the personal side of my life in terms of divorce and things that were tough. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. What about my life? And so you can see, I was a banker in black suits with a necktie. Then I got married, and I thought, you know, I wore the apron and tried to wear lipstick when I was cooking dinner, and I just worked for 12 hours. And then I had kids, and I got a lot of pressure to drive carpools and hand roll sushi and organic food for the lunches and all that sort of pressure. And then the non-working moms, the things that they would say to me when I was racing off in the schoolyard to catch a flight, how do you leave your children? How do you do that? And I'd get on the plane crying and be like, I'm not evil, but I'll leave it anyway. And then I swung the other way and said, I'm going to be super wonderful, and I'm just going to do everything and do it really well. And then I crashed and burned, and I won't say the ugly part of that, but it was 3 years of complete, utter crashing and burning, divorce, depression, everything you could imagine because of all of this. And then I had a couple profound experiences. I went off to Haiti and did some work with 60 Irish CEOs, which was incredibly profound. And I lived in China, so it wasn't unusual for me. But I just got back to who I am again, and I'm so glad because I'm still not too old, and I still have some life left in me. I'm really glad. So one of the assignments I have my female MBA student, well, the whole MBA class do, and the men in there too, is I get really tired of all this argument of can women have it all. First of all, because you never ask a man that. And secondly, because here's what happened to me. I tried on somebody else's definition of all, whether it was the non-working moms, the banker that I reported into or had to play golf with because that's where the deals went down and I hate golf, or, you know, the happy, beautiful house with handmade Christmas decorations and projects, gingerbread houses that you spent 12 days making. It didn't fit. You know, so no wonder I crashed and burned. And so I have my MBA students, before they leave the classroom, define their all. Just literally define it. And because my theory is, and I don't have proof on this, but that it's more likely to fit them if they actually made it up, created it. So what I learned from my trip to hell and back, I did like corporate strategy. I made a personal strategy, and I thought, what do I want to feel when I go to bed at night? What do I want to think? And I asked myself, was I authentic today? I'm being really authentic with you. Was I bold? Did I do something that made me breathless or freak somebody else out or, you know, got me called an asshole? Was I connected? Because what I really learned, you know, in all of these roles, I wasn't really connected to myself or to anybody else. And then was I useful? Somebody else other than myself. And it really helps. And not every day, I don't always say I did all those things. I went to a Harvard Business School, so this goes into the next slide. I was invited by a friend to Harvard Business School Alumni Women's Dinner Monday night. And I'd been at a nonprofit board meeting all day, so I felt like I was totally with some people. And who was talking about nonprofits? Sorry, I was looking to you. And then I trekked up the hill to the Ritz and went to this dinner, and I had to, you know, I walked in into the bathroom. Of course, that's where I stopped any time I walk into some place, and there are all these really tall, long, beautiful women in the bathroom with all their makeup and just brushing their hair, and they're like, yeah, I got dressed at 4 in the morning, so I really need to redo my hair, and, you know, I brought out my chapstick. And then I went down to the reception. It was jam-packed, and I had this moment of, I am getting the hell out of here. With Chris, my friend, noticed that I didn't show up. And I called a friend of mine, and he's like, yeah, leave, that sounds horrible. Sounds like a bunch of chicks with dicks. He's like, leave. So I started on L there, and I thought, no, I can't do this, Kelly, this is not right. Chris invited you. So I went back in and finally found Chris and sat at her table, and it turns out she was getting an award. She was the honoree. For the night, and I didn't even know it because she didn't tell me. She said this would be a great networking event for you with your women's work. And throughout the night, you know, I was very pointing my fingers at them. And when I went home and realized it was my problem, that wasn't their problem. They couldn't help that they're rich, powerful people. Good for them. They're running this world. I sat next to the president of Java and Sheryl Sandberg was at our table, and it was, you know, good for them. And so I teach this, right? I teach this concept called the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Who knows what the imposter syndrome is? Okay. It means you feel like you're a fraud and somebody's going to find out any day that you don't belong here, that you got in because you're a woman, that you're pretending, and you don't take credit for your own work. So if somebody compliments you and say, yeah, thanks, I was lucky, or I had a good team, or I had a good mentor, and as opposed to saying, yeah, thank you. I saw this, and I used it with my class. If you find yourself asking yourself or your friends, am I really a writer? Am I really an artist? Am I really a manager? Am I really a professor? Chances are you are. The counterfeit innovator is wildly self-confident. The real one is scared to death. I was scared to death, mostly in the bathroom, because I was scared. So finally, if you have time, this is amazing, because then I have some things you can do. Last video, if you could play this. I love it. Dove has an amazing campaign. I'm sure you've seen it. Real beauty.
Oh, yeah.
So this is their latest.
And then it up already?
He teed it up on the internet. We had them both minimized.
Okay. So,
yeah, there it is.
All right.
Just talking for a little bit. I still wear makeup and my mom can't understand that. She says it enhances my features.
You're gonna age, embrace it. I embrace the age. I know, but I just can't.
I don't like my skin. It's been really blotchy and it's hard, it's really sensitive and it breaks out really easily.
I never ever take pictures of my hair down because it just looks really bad in all the pictures.
I think that a lot of girls compare themselves to what they see in magazines and, like, movies and videos.
I don't like my age or my wrinkles. There's nothing I can do about it.
The power to change and redefine what beauty is. The power is in your hands because now, more than ever, it's right at our fingertips. We can take selfies. At the end of this breakthrough experience, we're going to have a gallery show.
Social media is putting the reins in their hands.
the creativity of social media is definitely allowing you to start to define for yourself what beauty is.
Beauty is being strong and being brave and being happy with yourself.
The last thing I want to do is just give you some thoughts that I have on what you can go out of here and do. What all of us can go out of here and support each other in doing. Be aware of the data. Don't just start one conversation, start, you know, 58 conversations about this, because it's just getting it out there. I find men to be absolutely open to all of this. They just don't know. They're just unaware because they're leading a different life. Engage them. You can't get anywhere if you don't get men in the room. You have power by being at a place like University of California, Berkeley. Use it. Use the power of your voice. Speak up. Read lead-in. Sit at the table. Don't wait for your invitation to the party to show up. There's this great, Cheryl has this great strategy for people to start lean-in circles at their own, in their own organizations. You know, everything else that's up here, take selfies. Take them tonight with your daughter, with your mom. Real selfies. Dump the imposter syndrome and really just go out there and be lionesses. And two last inspirational thoughts. You know, you sit around and say, somebody's going to do something about that, and then at some stage you've got to realize you are somebody. And Hillary, I love, this is not a political plug, but she really just says it straight. Women are the most underused resource in the world. Thanks for letting me take you on a personal